right, well, this is my first house concert. And, you know, it's a great concept from the perspective of the audience. How is it from the perspective of the performer?
Well, I mean, in general, I think it's wonderful. I think it's been a real way to support music in a very non-music business kind of way, where it's a very cozy community thing that has a lot of dimensions to it that sort of a normal show doesn't have. There's much more of a neighborly community feel to it, and there's nothing more intimate than playing in somebody's home. It's mm-hmm. really a wonderful feeling to it. And typically at a house concert, the artist gets all of the door, mm-hmm. which is wonderful.
Sure.
You know, the limitations are you can only fit so many people into a home, and the other limitation sometimes is the fact that, like tonight, they didn't have a PA. And that sometimes is a problem, depending on how the room sounds, and you know, it's a little bit more difficult sometimes to communicate the subtlety of what you're doing.
Probably makes you work harder as far as actually playing.
Yes, and singing. Yeah. You know, it's more. You just have to be concentrating more on projecting and whatnot.
Yeah. Your recordings use a lot of overdubs, like especially harmonies. And so touring solo must make it feel like there's something missing.
Well, you know, it's funny because I think maybe for the audience it might feel that way if they have been familiar with my records
right.
before they come to see me. For me, it doesn't really because I do it all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So I write my songs solo. And then when I go to the studio, I'll just kind of build on them, you know. But I usually record the tracks solo first, and so for me, I'm more accustomed to it, but I do think that it's a trick to try to make records that aren't too produced so people experience a disconnect between me as a live performer and the records. And so Elements, the one that you did, that was actually a response of mine to people who wanted something that represented the live thing more, because they got kind of frustrated because they'd see my show live. Perhaps they saw me live first, and then they buy the records and they think, well, this doesn't really feel like the experience.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well, the title track from your latest CD, Earth Town Square, you mentioned this when you were doing the introduction, seems to espouse the virtues of the global village and international exchange of ideas. It's nice to see a positive spin on that concept, since a lot of social observers kind of focus on the negative, like McDonald's taking over the world.
Yeah.
You know, cultures losing their traditional heritage. Do you think a shrinking world is really a good thing?
Well, you know, at the end of that song, for me anyway, is a question mark. And the question mark is, you know, will there be room for everybody there? And the song, that's the lyric.
Mm-hmm.
And I do think that it's a real concern, you know, the people who are, to put it simply, anti-globalism. I think there's more, not so much that people are anti, I mean, we are global. That's just the way the world is right now, and I think a global consciousness is very, very good. But I think a global economy needs to be constructed in a very compassionate way, mindful of people's rights and whatnot. And I think that's the problem. I think, you know, the corporations have tended to get there first before the laws protecting people's rights. And not only that, but I think oftentimes corporations look for the places where there aren't laws protecting people's rights
that's
in
right.
order to make right. money. And so there is a real problem there, and I think that all of that is really important to try to learn about and try to be conscientious of, and to develop regulations and just a consciousness of that in corporate America. But I do think, other than that, it's probably inevitable. A lot of that stuff is inevitable.
Okay, right.
You know,
it's just
going to
happen.
Yeah, it's going to happen, and in a way, it's just how can we do it and do it in a very humane way that's going to respect everybody. It's like, can you? I don't know, but try anyway.
Tell me what made you put Rowland Pritchard's 1800s hymn to words on Blue Boat Home.
Well, that song has been a part of my life always. I mean, I grew up in the Catholic Church, you know, singing that song.
It sounded so contemporary the way that you did it.
Well, thank you. I've definitely sort of, you know, folkified it in my own way, but it was for me always a church song and always just something that really I just always have loved it, you know. And
it's a nice melody,
isn't it? It's beautiful.
I really like it.
And it was just. And it just kind of came when I was messing around on the guitar one day, and I kind of had that melody in my head, and I had an idea, a concept on the guitar for it, and so worked it out. And then
kind of happened.
It kind of happened. At least musically, it happened on the guitar, and then it was a matter of trying to come up with some words, because I like to try and come up with lyrics that aren't "quote unquote sacred" in a specifically Christian sense. You know, I like to try and find something that's a little more crosses boundaries and tries to be more global in that sense. So the words were harder for me, as they usually are, frankly, on that song than was the music.
Now you're based in Minneapolis, and it's always amazing to me that there's so many great acoustic musicians from Minneapolis. There's Steve Tibbetts, Preston Reed, Dean McGraw, Michael Monroe, John McCone. Why Minneapolis?
Well, I'm thrilled that you know about these people. That's really cool. Well, I don't know.
I have no idea. Long winters, you don't have anything else to do with the fire.
Maybe so. Maybe.
Are you from Minneapolis originally?
I am. Technically, now, you know, we Twin Cityans take issue with, if you're from St. Paul, not from Minneapolis, because that's over 10 miles from...
Excuse the faux pas.
Yeah. No, but I'm originally from St. Paul, the Twin Cities, and now live in Stillwater, about a half an hour east of the metro. Still sort of, it's a bedroom community in a lot of ways, but it's a very historic town. But that's a long answer to say, yes, I am from that area, and still live there, and I would imagine we'll, you know, pass away there, because my family all lives there, as does my wife's, and so, yeah, but that's a good question. I've really been inspired over the years by the music there, but I don't know why that is necessary. I'm glad that somebody who sees it from outside of that community thinks of it as a hotbed, because that's nice to hear.
There seem to be a disproportionate number of great artists coming from there. Mark Anderson.
Steve, if you know Tibbetts.
I'm familiar with him from Steve Tibbetts.
Okay.
But his experimental jazz style is like 180 degrees from what you play.
Oh, I know.
And I'm wondering if you had to twist Mark Anderson's arm to get him to play mainstream music that you play.
Well, you know, he really just produces my records. He hardly ever plays with me because I travel. You know,
You're a great match because, you know, you have a very percussive style, and he complements your style.
Yes, well, thank you. And I love Mark. I just love him as a person and as a musician. But he plays with me, like, usually I have a big fall show in Minnesota, and then he'll play with me at that. But other than that, I'm solo, like, all year, and usually playing out of the area, so it's, you know, he can't really tour with me. But I have a great respect for him and admiration for his sort of out-of-the-box way of approaching music, and I just really, really like him a lot. He's a real spiritual person and a very grounded person and easy to work with, I'm glad to say it wasn't that tough to twist his arm, but I think it's getting even easier now that we know one another.
Good.
We've developed a relationship. So
who's influenced your guitar style?
Well, Preston Reed, Michael Hedges, a lot of the great finger stylists over the years, I've really been student of just American fingerstyle guitar. I have a good friend, Dan Schwartz, who's based in the Twin Cities, and he among other things, makes my transcripts. I have a half dozen transcripts of my songs. I'm sort of doing them one at a time. But anyway, Dan has passed along a lot of tricks from people he's studied over the years, too, because he shares that interest in American fingerstyle. Mm. So I'd say anybody who kind of like really sort of pushes the instrument in creative ways, I've really been interested in, you know, tried to learn what they're doing. I'm kind of slowing down now, you know. I mean, it really is affected. My hands have affected the intensity with which I approach the instrument as a student, mm-hmm. because I love to learn on the guitar and see it as this endless world of possibilities, but it's a physical thing.
Yeah.
But anyway.
Are your transcripts available publicly?
Sure, yes. I'd be glad to send you some of those.
Are they on the website?
They're you can link, well, Peppermint.
Mm-hmm.
They're available at Peppermint.
Okay.
Are they
written out in tablature? Or
they're very, very detailed. Tab, notation, chords, lyrics,
great.
Performance notes. They're very
cool.
Very detailed, yeah. There's only about, like I said, about six of them now. But I'm intending to do a book down the road, and I'm trying to just do them one at a time. So.
Great. So what do you do when you're not playing music? I think folks especially want to know if you own a Harley Davidson.
Oh, God. No, I don't. I don't.
So that was all fantasy, huh?
The thing is that my wife and I used to live across the street from a bar that was frequented by Harley riders. And so we would kind of observe the comings and goings.
You saw your dentist over there?
I'm convinced that I saw some dentist. But, it's an interesting culture, the Harley culture, and I think worth a little bit of a jab, you know, now and again. What do I do? I spend time reading and writing songs. I mean, I think that I kind of see, that's one thing I love about songwriting, is I feel like you sort of take your whole life, your whole life kind of becomes sort of process by which you generate, songs. Like any writer, I suppose, you draw from all aspects, and so I feel like, gee, every time I read a book and stuff, I kind of can justify it because, well, I'm a songwriter, you know? And so I like to read. I'm a very slow reader, but I try to keep reading because I like to continue my exposure to the language. I feel that's good for my writing. And I just really love the place that reading puts me in terms of my view of the world and whatnot. And I don't know. I'm an aspiring amateur astronomer, just like I mentioned tonight. I mean, I kind of am. I'm kind of like excited about that right now. So that's about it. I guess I have a little kayak that I go on. We have a beautiful river and. We live very close to it that I go paddling on occasionally and stuff.
There's probably a lot of introverts out there who love you for writing the introvert song, since ducking into a bathroom stall to avoid someone might seem a little bit more okay now. Do you think introverts have an edge over extroverts when it comes to creating musically?
Oh, I don't know. I would never presume that, just because I just don't know. But I tend to think that introvertedness lends itself toward creativity. Because the introverts are the ones that don't engage with others. They just stare out the window
and pick up tunes.
Yeah, exactly.
Poems.
Yeah, they're the daydreamers, I guess.
Well, you're known for soul-searching themes. Was there ever a time when you wrote just plain old love songs?
Nope, there never was. And, I have to say that it was a kind of a, to some extent it was a deliberate choice on my part to not write love songs, because I was a little bit, just ticked off about what I, in my own righteous way years ago about the appalling superficiality and cliched nature of popular music.
Amen.
Yeah, well, I'm glad I'm not offending here. But I just see the song as this incredible potential carrier of meaning for every subject that you could think of, and yet, you know, we have sort of reduced it to the, in some ways, the common denominator among people. It's like, well, you know, who doesn't like love? You know, I mean, of course everybody likes love. It's a great thing, you know, but it is truly gotten out of hand, I think, over the years.
It's been beat to death.
It has been beat to death, yeah. So anyway, it was somewhat a deliberate choice for me to just say, okay, I'm just not going to do it. I'm not going to write a love song. But I think nowadays, I think partly it's like, I see it as a bit of a deficit on my part, because I would love to, like, write a love song, like, for my wife, and I can't do it. I mean, I can't do it in a way, at least so far, I haven't been able to do it, that just doesn't make me stop halfway through and just think, that's stupid. You know, even though I'm crazy about my wife, I'm just crazy about her.
Well, when you finally do it, it's going to be great.
Yeah, okay, well, I'm glad you think so.
You're building up to it.
Yeah.
One of your themes is recognizing the fantastic in everyday events, like in your songs Holy Now and The Play. And why do you think people have so much difficulty in viewing life in this way rather than as a drudgery?
Well, that's a really good question. I think it's natural. I think life can be difficult. And you know, here I am, not to focus on my tendonitis, but here I am like, oh, I got my hand hurts, you know, and so I spend my days worrying about my hand and, you know, is it going to be okay and blah, blah, blah. And that's just my hand. I mean, my, you know, sister-in-law has cancer, you know, and my brother is battling depression. And I think that our lives are just they can be very stressful, and it's easy to forget the sheer mind-blowing fact that we're alive, and that the ultimate, the extremely mysterious aspect of that. I mean, when you think about it, I cannot think of a weirder thing, really, than life itself. The fact that we're all here, that we're talking, that we're alive, that we're breathing, that is the most fucking amazing thing, you know?
Well, yeah. Nick Constantino, Carlos Constantino said, step outside and look up, and we're surrounded by forever. You know, talk about a fantastic, mind-blowing thing, you know? You just gotta look up and go, Jesus Christ, you know?
Yeah, yeah. And once you get into that space, really, it is transforming, isn't it? I mean, if you can take the time to go outside and look up and sort of behold and put yourself there, I think something happens to you. And but it's kind of an exercise. I don't think it always happens naturally, especially depending on your personality.
Mm-hmm. Well, your song, The Play, really put that poetically very well and very succinctly, and thanks for that.
Well, thank you for saying so.
Just a couple other questions. Another theme of yours is people seeking or finding an extraordinary defining moment in an ordinary life, such as in your songs, John's Garden, which you did tonight, and Astronaut Dreams, which you did tonight, too. In both these songs, the subject has to exert some incredible will to rise above the expectations of his peers for him to underachieve, to kind of fit in. And you must believe that there's some value in just the act of taking a risk for a dream like that, especially given that failure can be a real outcome for some of those people who go out on a limb. I think it's...
Yeah.
I think there's value in just taking a risk, even though you may fall on your face.
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny because I think the older I get, the more I appreciate the importance of that way of living, because I think it tends to be more difficult, you know, to be kind of that risk taker.
It's easier when you're young, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah, isn't it? And you kind of tread the same path when you get old, and you get a little more
fossilized.
fossilized is a great word. Afraid could be a word, you know. But yeah, and I think it's probably in the chemicals of the body in some respects. But I do think that those moments where you can step out of the box a little bit and do something crazy, you know, which becomes less of a threshold, or you know, something crazy when you're our age is less crazy than when it was back, you know, 20 years ago. So it doesn't take as much to sort of make you feel alive and getting back to that whole sense of wonder. I definitely, you know, kind of getting back to that, I do think that in some ways that that's kind of it's almost the key to life in some ways, I think, is learning to cultivate that in oneself. You know, because a lot of us, I think, because of some dissatisfaction with life or a sense of unhappiness, we'll do all sorts of things to kind of fill that, whether it's consumerism or, you know, materialism, consumerism, which I think is a real problem in our society, or whatever, drugs, or, you know, whatever one can become addicted to. And so I tend to think that the person that can kind of cultivate that sense of wonderment about life itself really is doing society a service, you know, because you become this presence then for other people that, you know, is kind of this catalyst for happiness or something. I don't know. But I can't think of, in some ways it kind of gets back to that.
Because we get surrounded by paradigms, you know, and in an introspective person, you know, you see that and you step through your paradigms, you know. That's what I like to try and live my life, you know, just to recognize paradigms that keep holding me back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. We have certain, paradigms like that that we just think that's just the way it is.
And then there's nothing past it.
Exactly.
And all of a sudden,
yeah, this is the way you live life. It's just that's the way it is, and yeah, it's so easy to get caught up in that stuff. Yeah. Yeah, so.
Well, what can you tell us about your next release?
Well, I'm working. I wish I would have played some. I didn't play a single song from it tonight. I have several songs finished. It's a project about. It's basically a Christmas record, a Christmas solstice record, and I want to do all original songs. And I always joke with people, it's mostly because that there's not enough Christmas songs in the world, you know. So I just felt like on a mission to do this. But I do really like the theme because it's just so what I am drawn to in terms of my spiritual bent and my, you know, it's all about light and darkness and magic and just all these things about that time of year that really people practice all the rituals and stuff. And in some ways it's kind of a dialogue with the stories and symbols of my childhood. You know, I grew up Catholic and I'm no longer Catholic, but I still see power and resonance within me with those things. And so how do they play in my life now? So there's a few things that are more kind of taking the symbols of Christmas and other things that cast a wider net and talk about solstice time, talk about, which I think really is the mother of the holidays, is the fact that it's done.
These are not traditional carols, these are original songs?
These are all original songs, and it's a fair variety. You know, some of them are more take the, like there's one about one of the wise men, you know, told from the point of view of one of the wise men. This is inspired by a T.S. Eliot poem about one of the magi who's telling the story as an old man now. And so there's one of those, and then there's one about called Stables, which is talks about how there are stables in the world today waiting for love to come to them, you know, and then there's one about the stars, about astronomy, or inspired by the galaxies, and this metaphor about there being galaxies as there are snowflakes in a snowstorm. So there's one, so it's meditation on that. So there's just a variety of things like that, but kind of loosely or more specifically around solstice and Christmas.
You don't necessarily have to market this for Christmas sales, then, it sounds like.
Well, it's going to be weird because because when you put out a Christmas record, most people think, oh, geez, there's going to be all of my favorites on there. Pete Mayer's singing my favorites, you know, and I think in some ways that's going to be a negative. I'm not gonna offer that to people. But I like to think that the positive thing is that this is gonna be maybe a record that people don't just spin during Christmas.
Yeah. You know,
maybe there'll be something in there for other times of the year too. But it's fun. It's fun for me. It's a little more excuse to delve into sacred music, which is, even though, you know, I don't think of myself as a Christian anymore. I have a real love for sacred music.
That comes through.
Yeah, yeah. And it's a little more, my background is liturgical music. You know, I love church. I love that meditative aspect of what music can give us. So it's a little more step maybe in that mm-hmm. direction with some of this stuff.
Reminds me a bit of David Wilcox, because he seems to have a spirituality in his music,
yeah.
but he doesn't come out and proselytize.
Yeah.
He does a very subtle job, but a very effective job.
Mm-hmm. So. Yeah.
All right. Thanks.
Yeah. Oh, thanks a million. Well, it was just a pleasure to talk with you guys. I'm just really grateful for you taking the time to come out and to do this. And it just really means a lot.
Thank you very much.
It was good. Yeah, nice to meet you, Rob.